And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Martin Willis, your host. And we do not have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the news. He's on a beach somewhere in Southern California as we speak. Well, our guest tonight is Richard Sauder, Ph.D., and we may get a little bit off of the UFO topic. We'll be talking about his books and a lot more. His books include, not especially in this order, but Underwater and Underground Bases, Hidden in Plain Sight, and Underground. And so he'll be a real interesting guest coming right up. I want to thank everyone for their support. If you have not subscribed to hear the second part of the show, please go to our website. It can cost you just a dollar or more a month. And all that information is right on the website. You can always hear the show 100% for free live and right here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. And anyone that signs up for $10 or more gets a free T-shirt. And we have a couple people that signed up recently. I want to thank Sean, Paul, Carl. Thank you all for signing up. I appreciate that. Now, Alejandro, like I said, is not here, but I'm going to just do a little bit of the news myself. And all of these news stories, you can see the links to the original stories and pictures, etc., right in our show notes on podcastufo.com. Well, similar UFOs appear over Japan and U.S. cities, and this was written by Lee Spiegel. Strange lights over Osaka and Milwaukee, both, and they're very, very similar. If you look at the pictures, you can see the picture right on our show notes of how these look almost exactly alike, and they could be Chinese lanterns, but they look kind of white for that. And one of them, I think, was really interesting because the one in Milwaukee was videotaped and posted to Facebook, and this was by a Wisconsin police officer, and it was right near Milwaukee on July 25th. And his last name is Rojas, Gustavo Rojas, and he and his partner saw these lights maneuvering around in the sky and forming strange patterns before they eventually vanished. And again, Lee Spiegel wrote about that and Huffington Post. And the next story I want to talk about is UFO watching the Apollo landing. Even NASA won't say. NASA hasn't been able to explain why it looks like an image that was taken during the Apollo 11 moon landing. It looks like a piece of the moon is like lifting up, or some people are speculating it's a UFO. I think the unusual part of this whole thing is that NASA doesn't have an answer for what it is. It looks like some type of anomaly. Could be something natural, almost like a mirage type of thing. It's awful hard to say, but it's a great-looking picture. I hope you check it out on our website. And another story I think is really interesting is a new cave was found with paintings that look like UFOs and look like aliens. And this was discovered in India. And there's also some, like, ancient code. And that's 10,000 years old, they're speculating. And if you look at those pictures, it looks just like a craft with a beam coming down. And it sure does look a lot like aliens. I'm not really sure what they are. But it's a great article. And you can see, again, that's in our show notes. And so that is about it for what I have. And Alejandro Rojas will be back next week, and we'll be doing the news per usual right here. All right, so our guest is upcoming. And if you hold on right, you know what? I'm not going to do a music break. We're going to introduce him right now. Richard Sauter, are you there?
Thank you. Yes, sir, I am.
Thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be with you.
Yes. So, Richard, why don't you give your quick background to the listener who may not be familiar with who you are?
Well, I'm a native Virginian. I was born and reared in Virginia on the east coast of the United States back in the late 50s and 60s and early 70s. And since then, I went on to work and live and study and travel and be active in many other of the American states. At present, I am living in a voluntary exile in Ecuador. I would like to remain here. I prefer to remain in Ecuador. I intend to remain at any rate in South America. I do have some academic degrees. I have a degree in sociology, in Latin American studies, in political science, and a fourth degree in forestry and ecosystem management. I'm perhaps best known for my series of little books on underground and underwater bases and tunnels. And in recent years, I have a blog called Event Horizon Chronicle.blogspot.com. That's Event Horizon Chronicle.blogspot.com. And my blog is very widely read, more widely read than I would have expected when I started it. But there's quite an international following and a very solid plug of thousands of people in the United States also who read my blog. And that's a little about me.
Uh-huh. Now, do I get the hint that you may be becoming an expat? You may move to South America? Is that what you just said?
Much money, without much money, and I have very little money. Just to get rid of your United States citizenship costs a few thousand bucks that I don't have. And then acquiring a residency visa in another country costs many more thousands of dollars that I don't have. So for want of money, it's not a very feasible route for me. Mm-hmm. Unless and naturalize that way. So far, I have not met the woman that I would prefer to marry. And so I haven't pursued that avenue. There's more than one way to skin a cat, but yes, if I were financially able, I would actively be furthering the expat agenda. As it is, I am making my way with very little scratch. It's been a struggle, but here I am.
Yeah, yeah. And your books, are they pretty well read? You had one, I saw you have some on Richard Dolan Press.
Well, my latest book, which came out in 2010, is Hidden in Plain Sight, Beyond the X-Files, which deals with the underground and underwater base policy area or reality, and that's with Richard Dolan Press. And then I have my two earlier books, Underwater and Underground Bases, and then my first little book is called Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? And those are being handled by Adventures Unlimited Press in Illinois. So, and all of those books can be accessed from my website. Those who go there can find the book covers on the right-hand sidebar and just click on them.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the people I've wanted to get on the show for a long time, or someone I wanted to get on the show, I should say, is someone that could talk about USOs, you know, the unidentified submerged objects, because that's been kind of a fascination of mine. And I'm sure with these underground bases, does any part of that touch on the USO?
Well, not directly, but you know, the book that first attracted a lot of attention to that subject was written by the late American biologist Ivan T. Sanderson, and was entitled Invisible Residence. He goes into that subject in that book and talks about the many unidentified submarine objects that have been seen all over the world for years. One of the places in the United States where a lot of that activity has been observed is in Lake Erie, in the Great Lake region. I don't assume just because an object is seen going into or coming from the ocean or any other body of water, that it must necessarily be an extraterrestrial craft, i.e. an interplanetary UFO or something like that. It could quite easily be terrestrial technology developed by the United States military-industrial complex, among others. In the case of Lake Erie, the geology under a lot of that area, under the Great Lakes region, is actually pretty favorable for tunneling and making underground installations, that is, and also underwater beneath the Great Lakes themselves. That is because there's a thick stratum of deeply buried rock salt in that region, and a lot of it lays under Lake Erie. It also extends over to the Detroit area. Detroit is actually built over a massive, very deep underground working salt mine that's been down there for the better part of a century. Now, in the case of Lake Erie, there are actually mines that go offshore under the lake bed, and the shafts are sunk down, and then the tunnels go out. I think in the Cleveland area, there's a facility like that, and one or two others on the shore of Lake Erie there in Ohio. And what I'm telling you is you don't need to have extraterrestrial interplanetary technology to make tunnels and openings that would be capable of accommodating human beings, for example, in a breathable atmosphere. You can do it with off-the-shelf 20th century mining technology, and in fact that was done, and those mines are there. So it could be that either the military, United States military, or some other secretive organization or corporation made facilities under Lake Erie. Now, I believe the stories that I've been told about objects coming and going from Lake Erie, and I believe also that Ivan T. Sanderson mentions this in his book, Invisible Residence. Well, this activity has been going on for years. It's not just a one-time thing. I strongly suspect there are facilities beneath the lake bed of Lake Erie, down in the sub-lake bottom geological strata. Exactly who is down there and exactly what they are doing, I do not presume to know. But I know the geology is favorable for tunneling there. Rock salt is comparatively easy to excavate and tunnel out. And in the case of a covert government operation, they could just take the rock salt and sell it on the market through a front company and recoup some money or earn a few million dollars of extra black funding. So that wouldn't be difficult to do from the standpoint of modern mining technology or civil engineering technology. And the same goes for the Detroit area and running over underneath a fairly large region in that part of North America.
Now, I remember hearing something about some type of base, or, you know, I mean, it was talked about a lot off of the coast of Florida. Has any of your research looked into anything about that in particular?
Well, which coast are you talking about, the Atlantic coast or the Gulf coast?
I thought it was the Atlantic coast, but I'm not sure. Toward Bermuda or something.
Well, if it were toward Bermuda, that would be actually further off than just the continental shelf. Bermuda is about, what, 400 miles off the coast. It's several hundred miles out to sea. Mm-hmm. That whole area, though, whether you're talking about the continental shelf of North America or on the other side of the Florida Peninsula in the Gulf, the technology certainly exists to make underground or undersea facilities. I talk about this in my second and third book on this topic, in underwater and underground bases, and then in Hidden in Plain Sight, Beyond the X-Files. The technology to do this has been around since at least the mid-1960s. I was told by one of my sources who went silent on me after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. But before that happened, he was telling me about an installation that Parsons has ostensibly made in the Gulf of Mexico. He believed it was in the, somewhere in the eastern or northeastern Gulf of Mexico. He worked with a mining company that provides a certain kind of life support system that is only used in deep underground excavations. In the case of this particular project, he was told that the equipment was for use in a facility in the northeastern Gulf of Mexico or the eastern Gulf of Mexico. And because that equipment is only used in a deep underground hard rock mining environment, he knew that it had to be used in a sub-sea floor type of environment because the project was in the Gulf of Mexico, not near to it, but in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, the technology to tunnel out under the seafloor from onshore or to tunnel out under the seafloor from an island, whether it's a natural island like Bermuda or the Bahamas, for example, has been around for a long time. Or, alternatively, to cut a large diameter borehole right in the seafloor and then sink a large stainless steel sealed tank or pipe into that. It would be large diameter, 8, 10, 20 feet across, into that with an airlock on it, seal it in there with rapid-setting cement, and then through the airlock, evacuate all the water that was inside the tube and introduce a breathable atmosphere. Then you can, through the airlock, put in a crew of miners, and also you can put in machinery to excavate under the seafloor with. And from the bottom then of that tube, which could be 50 feet long or 100 feet long, however long you want it to be, it could have living quarters inside it and life support systems. But from the bottom of that, then you could tunnel out and begin to make a network. And over time, you could expand it, keep bringing down more machinery, more personnel. And given even the technology that existed decades ago, you would have been able to make a tunnel system beneath the seafloor many miles long in just a few years. Now, this is all discussed in a document that I obtained from the United States Navy that came out of the China Lake Naval Weapons Station in 1966, entitled The Rock Site Concept, ROCKSITE. And the idea was exactly what I've explained. Under the rock site concept, the plan was to build very large, very deep manned installations beneath the seafloor, including well out to sea, I mean hundreds of miles out to sea, in which submarines, actual ocean-going military submarines, would come in and dock at berths inside these facilities, and the crews would then have areas for rest and recreation where they could live and work. The illustrations that I came across in my research indicated that these facilities were going to be designed to accommodate 4, 5, 6 large military submarines at a time, and they would come in through huge underwater airlocks, which would be, they'd have to be about 100 feet in diameter, and then the submarines would come through there and would dock way down beneath the ocean. And also the Stanford Research Institute came out with a very similar R&D or planning document just 2 or 3 years after that, expanding on that concept a little bit. And in these documents, there were a number of purposes given for these facilities. Of course, the military purpose, undersea submarine bases, and also undersea nuclear missile bases, where the nuclear missiles would be embedded in the seafloor in missile silos way down there, thousands of feet in the seafloor, or as scientific research stations for oceanography, for geology, for seismology, for a variety of different studies that you could do in that environment, or alternatively as industrial facilities, for example, as geothermal power plants, or as potentially as mines. You know, you might run across rich deposits of anything, gold, platinum, diamonds, whatever. The seafloor is quite rich. In mineral resources, or petroleum wells, oil wells down in these facilities down beneath the seafloor, where oil could be drilled away from the harsh undersea environment, and then the pipeline and siphon off the petroleum. So everything, I mean, anecdotal accounts I've been told, facilities have been built, and I strongly suspect, based on what I've heard and I've been told, that some of these are definitely not terrestrial human facilities, that there do seem to be some off-planet groups coming here. They may or may not be human, but it does appear some of them look pretty human, and for whatever reason have set up shop down way beneath the sea. For one thing, you get a whole lot of physical security by doing that, and only those with advanced technology that enables them to sail around thousands of feet beneath the sea surface could come calling. So that's a little bit of an introduction to that.
Thank you. Your mic is cutting out a little bit here and there, but we're moving along because there's really nothing we can do at this point about that. Pardon me. But what would be the advantage of having these underground? You did mention a possible geothermal power plant, but what would be the advantage for submarine bases? So they wouldn't have to surface, or what are your thoughts on that?
I don't know, and the documentation that I ran across didn't explain that. Why the Navy would want to have undersea submarine bases. One reason that was given, which I mentioned, was to put nuclear missile silos down in the seafloor, way undersea. I believe that may have been done. So that would be one reason. Another reason that was mentioned in literature I saw was to have undersea manned hydrophone bases or acoustic listening bases, where they would be able to spy on submarine traffic of other countries, for example, or ship traffic, or I would presume probably also on UFO traffic, since there seemed to be a number of UFOs coming and going from the oceans and seas of this planet. So that those are the things that I saw explicitly mentioned, not the UFO part, but the to have underwater acoustic or listening stations, and also the idea of stationing nuclear missile bases at great depth beneath the sea, along with a manned component. I think that may have been done. I do believe that in the case of bases for submarines, that it could give an extra layer of security to have some, shall we say, off-the-books nuclear submarines that go sailing around to secret underground bases, undersea bases, and they're off the books, and they go quiet for long periods of time because they are not in the water. They're actually buttoned up inside an undersea base. I wouldn't rule out that that is going on, but I'm not an insider, so I couldn't say for sure.
Now, what about underground? Well, before I move on, there was something that came up on the message board, and there's another radio host that claims there's this deep, massive underwater base somewhere off the coast of California.
You need not mention the host. I don't think much of the so-called, shall we say, in quotation marks, research that's behind that claim.
Okay.
I perceive that as pretty well grade A disinformation, whether willful or just down home, not knowing much what you're doing, I couldn't say. But I've looked at those, some of the images that have been posted to the internet. It's allegedly off of Malibu. How very Southern Californian can you get? But to me, it just looked like ordinary geological features. I didn't run across any reference to that in my research. I would, however, say that I do not discount the possibility of undersea facilities off the coast of California. However, the areas that I would look at in particular would be the Monterey area and further south, Long Beach area, and then going further south, the Channel Islands between L.A. and San Diego. Those would be the three places that I would most strongly suspect underground bases in the California region now. But this thing that's allegedly off of Malibu, I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm from Missouri on that one. You have to show me. And the alleged proof that's been put out on the internet, I'm sorry, it is not proof of an undersea base there. It just isn't.
Yeah, okay. Just for the live listener, if you'd like to call in the show and ask a question, that's 603-967-4030. If you'd like to jump in the chat room, that's right on podcastufo.com. A real easy sign-in for that. Here's another question on the message board. What is your belief regarding Philip Schneider's claim to the underground base at Dulce?
Well, let me talk about Philip Schneider a little bit, since he talked about me a little bit before he died. I did speak with Philip Schneider on the phone, and I told him, frankly, you know, the claims that you're making are what you're saying. I need to see some proof. You say you were involved in these projects for years. Show me some evidence of that. You must have some evidence. So he said, yeah, I'll send you a box of evidence, the documentation. And he never did. I never received anything from him. I believe I talked to him three times at the most, but I think it was two reasonably long phone conversations. He never sent me anything. And then he turned up dead. The other thing about that is, before he died, he was publicly saying that Richard Souter, a PhD architect who worked on the underground facilities, was risking something, his life or his well-being or whatever, to talk about these things. And clearly referring to me. But in the account that he gave that's out on the internet, my last name is misspelled. My personal credentials are badly misrepresented. I don't have a PhD in architecture. I've never had any involvement with the field of architecture, professionally or academically. I don't have any qualification in the field, never worked in the field. So that is just flat 100% wrong. And my name is misspelled. And then the other thing is, he says that I worked on these projects. And that is also flatly false as well. I have researched the topic, but I've never worked on those projects. I've never been any kind of insider. I've never been in the alphabet soup or worked for the corporations involved. So what I'm telling you is, if he could get my basic personal and professional details so wrong after talking with me on the phone two times at some length, then how are we to believe other more sensational claims of his? I've found him to not be thinking clearly at all. Now, and then he died. So what I'm telling you and your listeners is, flesh and blood person. I'm not a mysterious underground base or an elusive alien race here to do God knows what. I'm a flesh and blood man. I'm walking around and living my life like everyone else in the middle of society, and have been for decades. So if he could get my basic biographical and professional details so wrong, then I have doubts as to most of the rest of his story. Now, people will say, but he's got burn. He had burns on his chest. I never saw his chest, but giving that part of the story the benefit of the doubt, let's say he had burns on his chest or elsewhere on his body. Please understand that there are many ways in this world to get burned. And one of the least likely ways to get burned is being shot in the chest by an alien with some Star Trek ray gun. It's mm-hmm. Guys get burned all the time working on projects in their shop or taking a blowtorch to the oil pan on their car, some thick-skulled ideas they have. I mean, you might say, no one's that dumb to do that. Well, I'm telling you, it happens every day. I've worked in industry where I worked with blowtorch, with an acetylene torch, and I was really careful. I never got badly burned, a few sparks, and that's it. But when you're working with acetylene torches, with arc welders, with that kind of thing, you can get burned, and pretty badly, and it's not that hard to happen. So I don't know how Phil Schneider got burned, if indeed he was. And as for the rest of his story, the same thing goes. Just because he very melodramatically said in the months and couple of years before he died that, you know, I worked on a deep underground base in Dulce, New Mexico, and, you know, I was in a firefight with these little aliens and blah, blah, blah. Never seen any proof of that beyond Phil Schneider's say-so.
Right. There was a lot of controversy about that being some disinformation as well, the Paul Benowitz case and all that. I don't know if you ever...
Yes, Paul Benowitz case is very part of that whole disinformation. Paul Benowitz was set up by Richard Doty and other Air Force intelligence operatives at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico.
Right.
I did have some contact with the Benowitz family. You know, his laboratory, Thunder Labs, was right by the gate of Kirtland Air Force Base, and I used to live out there in New Mexico, so I went to the laboratory and talked with his son. The son was very evasive. By that time, Paul was not very communicative. He was still alive, but he was badly burned mentally and emotionally and psychologically by that whole episode. And He actually produced a map or two of the area just north of Dulce, the Archuleta Mason Peak area, and it is annotated with his markings, geological survey, topo map, topographical map. So I got a really good high quality topographical map of that area, and following to the contour line precisely the markings that he had made, I went up there and I climbed the place and I walked all over. None of what he had indicated on the map was there. You know, UFO hangar doors, ventilation shaft, this and that and the other thing. None of it was there. I did see a great number of perfectly ordinary rocks and pine trees.
That whole, there's something really eerie about that area of New Mexico. Did you feel that when you were there?
Well, it's called, the whole state is called the Land of Enchantment.
Right.
There are underground bases in New Mexico. There are at least two on the Kirtland Air Force Base, Sandia National Laboratory, and Loveless. There's a Loveless medical clinic there who does, they do medical research there, biomedical research, and God knows the fact that it's right there with Sandia National Lab and Kirtland Air Force Base immediately suggests to me that they do black budget research for the military-industrial complex. And then you also have the Monsanto facility, Monsanto Underground Facility, which was begun in the late 1940s, initially as a as an underground atom bomb assembly factory. They actually put atom bombs together down there. New Mexico, in the early years, the Cold War, was a great center for building atom bombs and the first generation of nuclear bombs. Of course, you still have Sandia National Laboratory there and Los Alamos National Laboratory just to the north of there in the Hemis Mountains. And they're both still very actively involved in those kinds of research and design and much more besides. But at that complex just to the southeast of Albuquerque, New Mexico, there is a serious underground component. It has been for many years. I talked to one expert who, when I say expert, I mean someone who really, really knows the field from the inside. And what I was told is that the Monsanto underground base is vast. I'm not saying it's big. I'm not saying it's large. He told me it was vast. Now, I'm prepared to believe that means that it sprawls for miles, maybe. My impression is, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 miles, just multiple levels. I couldn't tell you what's down there. I just couldn't. I think we're talking about a tangential, compartmentalized society that exists on our home planet about which we know practically nothing. The few crumbs I found in my research, I'll actually qualify that as saying the many crumbs, informational crumbs, and crumbs of documentation that I found in my research clearly reveal that there's been a 70-year-long program now of major underground and, it seems, undersea construction as well, and yet we don't know what's happening down there. I suppose we might know 1%. The other 99%. It's so massively funded, so secretive, so large, so high tech. God knows. We are being played. That's what I'm telling you. We are being played, and we don't even know how badly.
I've heard, you know, rumors of the black budget being like this massive amount of money that goes, you know, that it disappears and no one knows exactly where it goes. So, yeah, it's would be hard to figure that out. I wanted to, there's a couple of questions up. I want to get to them and Just a second. There's one back here wondering if
what. Well, what we do know is that Schrodinger.
Are you there?
I could not hear you. Can you restate the question, please?
Okay. You dropped out. One of the questions up on the message board, they wanted to know what you thought about an underground base at Area 51.
Sure. I think Nevada has all kinds of tunnels beneath it, and Area 51 is one of those places. But not only Area 51. I think it's Fallon Naval Air Station, which is in the northern part of the state. And then you have S-4, you have Nellis Air Force Base, and other facilities here and there around the state. Nevada is New Mexico. It's tunneled out. It has a lot of military and government facilities, and we don't know what they're doing. I think something like 90% of Nevada is controlled by federal agencies, including large chunks by the Pentagon and the Department of Energy, which work very closely together. I have been told anecdotally that there are massive tunnels running out between Nevada and the desert areas in California. I listen to those stories with interest. I can't prove them. No one that's not on the inside has information about that stuff. So if you're not one of those compartmentalized need-to-know projects, you don't have firsthand knowledge of them. However, if you are on the inside of one or more of those compartmentalized need-to-know projects, you cannot talk about what you know and about what you do. So in some ways, people like me are the closest you get to finding out about that, short of signing your life away and going into that world, which I am not willing to do. But I take seriously these stories I've been told about of massive facilities beneath California and Nevada. You know, they're huge, wide-open areas of California that are extremely sparsely populated. You see practically no one when you go out there. And the same is true of Nevada. Once you get outside of Reno and Las Vegas, the rest of Nevada is pretty empty. Actually, most of it is extremely empty. The real action, I believe, or at least a lot of it, is going on underground.
And for the purpose of being underground, would that be just for secretive purposes? Is that what you're imagining?
Multiple purposes. Secrecy, of course. Well, that's one reason. Secrecy, of course, means that if you're out of sight and out of mind, you can conceal what you're doing from others. What people don't see, they tend not to know about, not to think about. But you would also have physical security. By being underground, you limit the access to these facilities, and so you can carry out your projects with more security. I mean, if it's a weapons project or if you're interfacing with aliens, as I believe is happening in some cases in some of these facilities, then you would be able to keep the idly curious general public away. Other reasons would be for command, control, and communication facilities, for government, for the military, for industry. Other reasons for some of these facilities is the storage of commodities or the storage of archival records. Government and industry produce reams of records. Supercomputing facilities are underground. One of the most famous ones that's publicly known is, at least semi-publicly known, is beneath the NSA headquarters in Laurel, Maryland. And then if the stories believe there are also highly secret transportation nodes and transportation networks underground for use, not by the general public, but by this very secretive, highly compartmentalized world of the military-industrial espionage complex. So those are some of the reasons. I'm sure there must be others.
Do you know anything about Pine Gap in Australia?
Well, you know, it's real. It's a large facility, high tech, very deep. It's in the region, in the area of the small town of Alice Springs, which is out in the Australian outback, almost exactly in the geographic center of Australia. It's way out there, and that part of Australia is like Nevada and the desert areas of California. It's very thinly populated. There's almost no one out there. Now, the facility at Pine Gap is an American facility, notwithstanding that it is located in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of Australia. It is controlled by the Americans and not by the Australians. It is run by the Americans and not by the Australians. The NSA has a major presence at Pine Gap. I believe, based on what I read, that the CIA is there to a degree, and also the National Reconnaissance Office and perhaps other agencies and organizations that we don't know about, but it's been there for many years. Its ostensible public function is as a satellite downlink or uplink. You know, the Americans have a lot of spy satellites, and so do the British. And they have ground stations where they communicate with their spy satellite network, and that's one of them. It's in the southern hemisphere, and so it has a strategic location on the other side of the planet from the United States and in the southern hemisphere. It's a working base. It's a high-tech base. It's very secretive. The stories about it are that it has deep underground levels, massive deep underground levels, and I believe those stories.
Uh-huh. One of the things that has come up earlier in one of my shows was Wright-Patterson Air Base, that there's a massive underground facility there. Did you look into that one?
Well, from what I've seen, yes, of course, Wright-Patterson is an Air Force base in Ohio. It's been there for many years. The story, the Roswell story, at least in some of the iterations, goes that the little alien bodies and some of the UFO debris collected from so-called UFO crash at Roswell, which was not at Roswell, was not at Roswell. One crash of one craft, but Wright-Patterson is often put into that story as an important element because it was for a long time a base where the Air Force analyzed and did reverse engineering on foreign technology. And I suppose UFO technology would qualify as foreign technology. and then, of course, there are stories about underground tunnels and work areas at Wright-Patterson. I've read some of that information. I think they have been there for a long time. I don't know how deep the stuff at Wright-Patterson goes. Listen, at any American military installation, you're quite likely to have one or more underground facilities. I say that because the black budget is so huge, running into the trillions of dollars. The document trail I found is so extensive, indicating ongoing military interest in underground tunnels and bases over a period of decades. And the secrecy and compartmentalization in the black budget world of the military industrial complex is so extensive that I don't rule out at any American military facility the possibility of a serious underground component, no matter how shabby and run down things may look on the surface. That is what my research strongly indicates, and so there could be a major deep underground facility at Wright-Patterson. The documentation I have seen suggests more modest, more shallower, closer to the surface tunnels and work areas. But, you know, that was from stuff from decades ago, and the technology that's around today permits construction at a very deep level. So I wouldn't rule anything out where Wright-Patterson is concerned or any other American military facility.
Right. It's amazing these machines they have for actually tunneling underground that can be 60 feet wide, I think it is, and it can go through bedrock, anything. Pretty amazing what they can do right now.
Yes, they can. The largest of these machines are just gargantuan. They're breathtakingly huge, and it's hard to believe that machines with that power, with thousands of horsepower, can just chew their way through solid rock, hundreds or even 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 feet underground. But that is the state of the technology and has been for decades. Now, you could even come in from miles away. It could be that there would be just using Wright-Patterson as one hypothetical example, since I've never been underground beneath Wright-Patterson and am highly unlikely ever to go underground beneath the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. But if you wanted to make a serious tunnel network beneath Wright-Patterson, you wouldn't have to start tunneling right there. You could, if you wanted to, you could tunnel in from 20 miles away or 50 miles away, and no one would be the wiser.
Right. A question up on the message board. Do you think any of the bases could function as protected spaces in anticipation for Earth disasters?
No, these facilities are not intended for thee and me. They are intended for use by the military-industrial complex and others. There really is no civil defense provision in this campaign. You are dealing with a compartmentalized parallel reality there that is does not have your best interest at heart. And I say that, or mine, because it is sucking money out of the economy by the trillions of dollars, money that we all need and could use for all kinds of things, productive uses. So right there, we are being robbed without our consent. Robbery is always a crime. It's always a violation of the other party's dignity, human rights, and civil liberties. And so the fact that a massive crime is being committed against us without our permission right there tells you that what is being done is not being done for us, but is being done to us.
Well, I think earlier someone said that Rumsfeld said that there was $2.3 trillion missing from the federal budget back in 2001. Have you followed that type of missing figures along the way here?
Well, you can't find out where that money went. What you have to do is rely on what you can find in open literature and newspapers and books and documents and journals and so forth, professional journals. At that time, he was talking about $2.3 trillion of spending that the Pentagon accountants could not account for. Now, just you try that excuse in your personal financial affairs. You know what? It's true there's $86,000 missing here, and the figures don't add up, but I'm on it. I'll let you know as soon as I have an answer for what's going on here, which has been the Pentagon's way of handling this, only it's so much worse. We're talking about multiple trillions, and that was 15 years ago. We do know that it's gotten even worse, and I'll tell you how. You can look at And it's not limited to the Pentagon. The Pentagon is just one appendage of what is going on. This is actually a global program. Something real big is going on this planet, beneath this planet, and above this planet, or off this planet. It's costing trillions of dollars. When you see that the Federal Reserve Bank, for example, is undertaking what it calls quantitative easing, what that means is it is creating money out of thin air by the trillions, and it is funneling it to large Fortune 500 companies on Wall Street, to stock brokerages, to major banks in the United States and in other countries around the world. And none of this is being accounted for. Representative Alan Grayson, who has been in the Congress, United States Congress, in recent years, has in congressional hearings quizzed high-ranking United States Federal Reserve Bank officials about this. I've written about this on my blog and a couple of my blog postings. In one case, he was grilling the inspector general for the reserve, who's investigating the spending of the Federal Reserve, falls under her purview. And she pled ignorance. There were a number of trillions of dollars that she could not account for in congressional testimony, and essentially was telling the congressman, I don't have those details immediately to hand in front of me right now, but let me get back to you. Well, let me tell you, if it's a question of trillions of dollars being spent, wouldn't you be able to say something about it? I mean, you can tell me if you spend $20 for something, what you spent it on. And here, trillions of dollars, literally trillions of dollars on the Fed's balance sheet were under discussion, and he was querying her about it, and she had no answer. That's how opaque the system is. And I'm suggesting to you that if a sitting United States congressman in sworn congressional testimony cannot get a straight answer, just consider how much harder it is for someone like me and other researchers like me. We're up against something huge that's hard to research, it's hard to understand, but what's clear is that trillions of dollars are being sucked out of the system in the United States and around the world. It's not being put to productive use in the so-called brick-and-mortar economy. It's not being – this vast sum of money is not being put to productive use or any visible use at all in the realm of in which ordinary people live their lives by the hundreds of millions and billions. So where is it going? Obviously somewhere else. It's going somewhere else. It's doing something else. My research shows what one of those things must be, demonstrably must be, and that is underground and underwater tunnels and bases. There's also a growing body of research that strongly points in the direction of one or more secret space programs, and again, not limited just to the United States. And then we also have this burgeoning artificial intelligence technology that's being brought online very rapidly now. Our world is being transformed at warp speed, and not in a good way if you're a natural human being. And then there's also genetic engineering and cloning technology going on. There are anecdotal stories from the Krista Tilton, Dulce-based stories from years ago in the 1980s, for example, that allege there are these high-tech secret underground laboratories, as at Dulce, according to one iteration of the Dulce story, Dulce-based story, in which beings are cloned.
Okay, that's it for hour one. We're going to be talking about all different types of subjects way off the UFO topic in hour two. And if you'd like to listen to hour two from here on out, it would only cost you a dollar or more a month. You can get that information right on podcastufo.com and sign up at Get Joy Ride. And thank you for listening to this part of the show. And we'll be back next week. Remember, keep your eyes to the sky.